regarding economic development and its importance in the land use planning process, and set out certain factors that are of importance in the process, and requiring LCDC or the commission to implement these, either in the adoption of new goals or rules or in the application and interpretation of existing goals and rules. These include that plans include certain economic analyses of economic potentials and strengths and deficiencies of the community, that they contain specific policies concerning economic development. They provide at least an adequate supply of suitable sizes and types and locations of industrial and commercial lands. They provide for compatible uses near sites that are zoned for specific industrial and commercial uses. And they provide for a public facilities plan if they are a city or a county within an urban growth boundary having 2,500 or more persons.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Day.
And that's on page 34, lines 9 through 15. And I can tell you that we tried very hard to achieve that during the last session, and were unsuccessful. But it's one that I think is extremely important. Now, this matches the House version. I know of no difference. There may be there may be some editorial that we proofread it a little better. But basically, out of all that, that is probably one of the more controversial sections in that area, and I just point that out to the rest of you. Go ahead.
Senator Day mentioned this was one of the provisions that I believe was undergoing some amendments yet on Friday in the House committee, and but as I understand it, the language is very similar to that contained here.
Importance, if I may, Mr. Chairman, I just one other, you know, they'll set aside industrial land. And Multnomah County is just an excellent example. I can take you up and show you over 2,000 acres of industrial land that can't be serviced. In other words, it's simply unserviceable. And they'll say, well, there's industrial land. But it did nothing to bring the service to that particular area. And that's true in many areas. They'll set out on zoning and say, okay, it's there, but they have not attempted to put together some type of plan. I think this is as important to land use planning as anything that we've got here. And I, someone also questioned the population of 2,500 or over, but that is, I've had some people ask me, that's the recommendation that at least I've had from most people, that is the right size, okay, is where we target it. So. Go ahead, Mary.
The provisions also include a requirement for state agency coordination for state agencies that provide funding for these public facilities, the transportation and the water and the sewage and so forth, that they show in their programs of coordination that I mentioned earlier how they will be coordinating that state funding with these public facility plans. Also, the provisions include one, that reasonable opportunities be provided for economic activities outside of urban growth boundaries, and in changes to the urban growth boundaries over time. And this was, again, a similar provision you will find in House Bill 2295, with a recognition that economic development issues are not limited solely to those typical urban, industrially zoned lands, that there is economic life outside of urban growth boundaries where appropriate. And that was the intention of the language of that provision. The sections also provide for technical assistance to be provided to local governments in carrying out these factors, and also technical assistance in just gathering the basic data and information. Also, you'll find in these amendments a recognition that serviceable lands within the urban growth boundaries are presumed to be available for urban development. So once inside that boundary and once serviced or with services available, they are presumed to be developable urban lands. Then with regard to sections 34 and 35, this is one of the major inclusions in these amendments that, of course, has not been addressed so far in the session, was not addressed in the House committee. This is the exceptions process. Essentially, these two sections, which are very simply worded, really, in our pattern, to some extent, to parallel the existing language within the LCDC goals, in terms of the process, respond to a problem that we've been hearing so much about, and that is the inability of our land use planning process to respond to individual circumstances, to local circumstances. There's a concern that the marginal lands concept or something of that nature draws yet another arbitrary line, and simply through a blanket definition of certain types of lands, you're going to have those people falling again on one side or the other side of that arbitrary line, and again, not feeling the responsiveness to their individual circumstances. The benefit of an exceptions process is that it can be a safety valve, if you will, to respond to these individual circumstances on a case-by-case basis. Not an all-or-nothing proposition in terms of applying the goal, or just absolutely not applying the goal, but to be able to fashion the tenets of our land use planning system to the individual circumstances involved. A couple of the problems that have been identified with our existing exceptions process, and I might just as an aside remind the committee that the exceptions process is not now set out in statute anywhere. It is not recognized legislatively. The statute simply say thou shalt comply with the goals. It is LCDC who, through Goal 2, has developed the exceptions process and said comply with the goals except when these circumstances exist. And this would provide a legislative recognition of the legitimacy of an exceptions process for those circumstances where it simply is not appropriate for whatever reason to apply the goals strictly to that particular set of circumstances or that particular land. Now, a couple of the problem areas that have been identified in our current exceptions process are in the basic standards that trigger the ability to take an exception. And that is that an exception may only be taken when it, quote, is not possible to apply the goal to the given situation. And then only when there are compelling reasons and facts. Now, these two standards mean that essentially an exception will not be allowed unless, given all the facts set out in a particular case, a reasonable person would be compelled, absolutely compelled, not just persuaded, but compelled that the goals could not be applied in that given situation. Now, the legal effect of those general provisions is that we have not developed a balancing test. We have not developed a safety valve in the process, if you will. The very general language is going to be interpreted specifically by the lawyers and by the courts, and if we have a problem with those standards that we have developed by that vague language, then this recognizes the need to change those standards. And essentially, in Section 34, this is what is done. This appears on page 36 of the printed amendments. Instead, two more general tests would essentially be created. It consolidates the many factors. The first test, first of all, would be that when it appears inappropriate to apply a relevant goal to specific properties or situations, the exception to the goal may be taken.
Marianne, it seems to me that if we're talking about vague language, it appears inappropriate. It's just about as vague as you can get. That does trouble me a great deal.
And certainly that phrase or that word that this committee or the legislature would come up with is going to be the key consideration, is when are we really saying
that's true.
It just doesn't quite make sense to strictly apply the goals to that particular situation. Right now, we've said when it's not possible. Well, if that language isn't making it, we're searching for that other word that tries to express the intent of the legislature to say, what do we mean by when it just doesn't quite make sense in that given situation? So that is, as you pointed out, the key word. Is when are we really talking about an exception being appropriate?
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Dick.
A couple of things I want to point out to you that I think we've got to look at this from a standpoint, and as I told you, I'm not married by specific words, but looking at an exception process, I think we have to look at it for three reasons. First of all, we can decide that we want to amend the goals, or we're going to produce a process that allows exceptions to be taken under some type of standard, and I think that's important. The second thing is that you've heard several people talk about the exceptions that have been granted that perhaps haven't been challenged. And in many cases, we've called that committed lands, where land's been zoned, it's been sold several times over, yet it wasn't all maybe used up at that given time. I think there's some question in my mind at this time that if someone were to challenge that acknowledged plan where these committed lands were involved, it could be some question raised over that. And I think that's why it's important we look at some section of this nature. How it comes out or how best to write it is, I think that remains to be seen. But instead of trying to go and change the goals considerably, or to try to find some way to handle the committed lands and pretend that we have some process that we don't have, is what's troubled me for almost 4 years. And I just point that out, that that's the other side of the coin. Now, the standard appears, what's better, you know, if there's some other idea on what standard should be applied. I think we're going to have to do it statutorily, because we attempted to do it through the goals, and we haven't done very well, because really the definition that we produce there, the courts and LUBA have not really, where it's been challenged, have not allowed it. Go ahead.
Thank you. Senator Dave points out a good point as well, and that is, at this point, there are two different types of exceptions that are being taken. That is, as Senator Dave referenced, the built and committed test, which is that land that was already built upon or committed to some use so that it physically was not possible to apply the goals. And then what has been called the needs exception, or when it just simply, given the equities of the situation or the applicability of the goals, we go through these various standards. The proposal before you in these amendments would consolidate those into one general balancing test. And aside from the word of appropriate or inappropriate, I think this, the various factors of the test set out here need to be looked at as a whole. Because what we're really saying is not so much to be keen in on the specific legal interpretation of what is not possible to apply or compelling reasons and facts, but we are setting up a balancing process at the local level to say, given the various circumstances and criteria and considerations that are appropriate and applicable to this given situation, what is the most appropriate in terms of meeting the goals as an overall, or meeting the best interests of the public in that situation. Going on through the criteria rather than the compelling reasons and facts, instead would be the normal standard for all land use decisions, and that is that it would be findings of facts supported by substantial evidence. This is the basic standard for all land use decisions now at the local level. Then as to the actual criteria, there would be two more general standards set out. One would be a general consideration of the benefits and detriments of the proposed use. That is, how the potential benefits of the goals and policies that are being met and the potential benefits of the proposed use outweigh the potential detriment from not complying with those other goals or policies, considering the long-term environmental, economic, social, and energy consequences to the locality and to the region and to the state. This combines several considerations of the existing criteria in the exceptions process, but it interjects that sense of balancing those benefits versus the detriments of not applying the goal in that particular given situation. The other general test is more location oriented, and that is why the proposed location is appropriate for the proposed use, considering, among whatever other factors the local government might consider, the availability of services, the compatibility of the proposed use with other adjacent uses, and the ability to mitigate those impacts on adjacent uses. So rather than going to an absolute standard of why this site, for planning purposes, is the best overall possible alternative site, wherever they may be, or an absolute test that it shall be compatible in all circumstances, to take into account the many factors that are involved in these situations and say, why overall is this particular site appropriate, given the impacts that it has, given the availability of services that it has, and so forth and so on. And that would essentially be the exceptions process. Now, the provisions would direct the commission to amend the goals and the rules to be consistent with this new provision, and would provide that any exception that has already been acknowledged under the commission's existing standards would remain valid and would not have to go back through the new test.
The next section, 36, extends the prohibition on adopting new goals until January 1, 1985. I believe the House bill repeals that particular section of the statute, and the House bill is silent, if I understand it. And if I understand
that's correct. That's
the
correct.
Meetings,
that's correct.
That were occurring the latter part of last week, why they were not addressing that question on what would happen with new goals. The next sections, 46 through 103, create the land use court to replace the administrative body that handles appeals now. And I wonder, Mary Ann has, in her lawyer-like fashion, listed some of the global differences between having an appeals handled by an administrative body or by a court. And rather than try to take you through the details of how this court is designed, it probably is would be easiest for the committee to make some policy decisions based on the differences between having it done as a court or in the kind of administrative fashion that we have now, and then proceed from there. It's my perception that in the House, they have simply renamed the existing body and moved the and divorced the that appeals body from the LCDC. And why they renamed it, I'm not privy to. I do not understand why they renamed it. I understand the divorce between the department, if you will, and the appeals body, and that's appropriate why they went through the process of renaming it. Somebody may be able to explain. I've never understood. Maybe Mary Ann, you'd try to explain the difference between the administrative appeals body and the judicial appeals body.
I guess I have one question of what you have here without asking you to go through it, and that is how you get to the vision is that you have a land use court and everything that's appealed from the local level would go to the land use court, and that is the final. And is there an appeal further on from the land use court? And just outline how the steps are that you've got it drafted here.
Discretionary to the Supreme Court.
Goes directly to the, it will go from the land use court discretionary to the Supreme Court.
That's correct. Mr. Chairman,
Sunday.
I've had people express in this land use court the greatest fear they have is the elective process.
I'm not concerned about that at all. I'm concerned about the impact on the court system and how it in fact would work and what costs and how one and the timelines that you are envisioning here and how that would work. That's my concern. I'm not at all concerned about the elective process one way or another. So. I don't know if you have anything to add to that.
Senator Cohen, just in response to your question, getting into some of the other general differences, with LUBA or a panel being essentially an administrative body that is not a part of the judicial branch, that right to appeal at least once to the judicial branch must be afforded. And that is why from any kind of a LUBA or a panel or whatever you might want to call it, that is not a judicial body, we must provide that appeal to the Court of Appeals. And then from the Court of Appeals, there is a petition for review with the Supreme Court, which is, of course, discretionary with the Supreme Court as to whether or not they would.
So you are in fact saying it would go direct to the tax court with the same discretionary. What would prevent them from appealing in the same way on a regular basis to the Supreme Court, except the Supreme Court's been turned down?
That would be the main difference, is that they would appeal directly into the judicial branch, and that would be the land use court. When there, you do not need to provide the appeal to the Court of Appeals, so they could petition the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court has the discretion to deny that petition in most cases, of course.
Chair, one more question
about
this issue. In your opinion, did you do research on the funding of it in the sense of whether it can pay for it, how much of an outlay we're going to talk about in terms of creating that kind of new system?
There has been, we don't have it with us today, but there has been some work that's been done since, well, in fact, it was introduced last session on the same issue that indicated, at least from the standpoint of the proponents, which at that time included Ed Sullivan, attorney, that this would not cost much more than the current system. Now, I wouldn't begin to verify that today's cost, but there has been at least the allegation made that it would not cost much more than the creation of an LDERP or the expansion of a Court of Appeals that could be done. Now, I can't verify that, but we'll get you some
information. Do you have jury trials in here?
No, jury trials would not be provided for, but it would consolidate, and this is another one of the general features of going to a court-based system, it would consolidate or bring together many of the other related land use type of actions that could occur that now are either taken to the circuit court at the same time or elsewhere. So in other words, like the declaratory judgment or injunctive relief, mandamus, things of that nature, would be taken from circuit court and instead taken up to the land use court. So
taken from, you mean appealed from?
No, I'm sorry. Instead of going to the circuit court for that type of relief, if it involved a land use type of an action, instead you would go to the land use court directly. And maybe the land use court at the same time is reviewing the local government decision on an appeal, and at the same time you're trying to get a mandamus of an action to relate, so you would have all of those actions in the same body at the same time. As Gordon mentioned, I know there are facts and figures available, and we will certainly get those for you as you get into the discussions further. But when looking at the cost impacts, I think it's important to look not only at just directly LUBA budget or something of that nature versus the land use court budget, but some of those other functions that might be taken from the circuit court in the court of appeals and put into this one review panel.
Yeah, I'm much more concerned about the process of how that scheme would work than some of the other land use court.
I touched on a couple of
the Chairman, one other thing I'd mention, we took this basically from 2 years ago, the language that appears in here, and I think they're right, we could probably get the actually, fiscal to give you some review on it, probably should. I know at that time they estimated there wouldn't be much more scores than what the current LUBA was doing at that time. So I don't think people really, we had to make a decision what you wanted. And LUBA, the reason that 2 years ago we really didn't pursue that very long is because there was a sunset provision on LUBA this time around. We left that to this session of the legislature.
A couple of those other major differences, in addition to consolidating all those related type of actions that might now go to circuit court, would also be broader powers to grant more full and final relief rather than simply reviewing the case and sending it back to the local level. The land use court would have more of the equitable powers of a circuit court to actually fashion relief in individual cases. Also, there would be a building of expertise to handling not only all the land use appeals from the local level, but also including the review of decisions made by LCDC. Rather than going to the Court of Appeals, which might deal sporadically with those types of issues, there would be one court that has some consistency in reviewing not only the commission actions on interpretations of the goals, but then also the local government actions that might be implementing those goals and so forth. This would also be relieving the burden on the Court of Appeals with regard to all of these types of land use actions. Now, the one difference is that as in House Bill 2295, appeals of state agency actions that are now handled by the Court of Appeals would be consolidated in the Court of Appeals. The day-to-day activities and actions, contested cases, rulemaking procedures, things of that nature that are appealable to the Court of Appeals would continue to be appealed there, even if they had some land use implications, and that is similar to two provisions in House Bill 2295. As I mentioned, it would remove one step in the appeals process, and that is the biggest difference, I think, and that is you do get into the judicial system directly from the local level, and from there have just one major appeals process to go through from their discretionary review in the Supreme Court. Of course, these would be elected judges in the judicial branch, and that was a significant difference. If you would like, I can go through any of the other more technical differences between the two appeals processes, but I don't want to burden you with too much detail either at this stage. Many of the basic review functions are similar to the panel in the sense of filing petitions and briefing and so forth, as required in 2295 with regard to the panel and under existing law with regard to the land use court.
That's it, Mr. Chairman.
So I don't know what you're making all this about.
Too, I'm making a fuss about it. I just want a bill that we can vote on, and it's 6 weeks late. But I appreciate you taking the time, Mr. Chairman. I really, truly do. And I, as I said, I'm perfectly willing to wait the arrival of House Bill 2295. I think that makes a lot of sense. If it gets here, I am a little taken back. I thought they were making all the amendments and had sent it to the floor, but if they're making further changes. And if they're making further changes, that'd be fine. But when we see what those changes are, then we can determine.
Okay. When is, Mr. Chairman, when is that due on the
It was passed out of committee Friday afternoon, but I understand.
No, it's supposed to be passed out tomorrow night.
Oh, is it?
So it could be on Friday. We won't get it till next week. Soon it passes. Any questions? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Well.
I'd rather wait until we get 2295 in here and take a look at it.
I'm going to take about a 10-minute recess till we get our mocked-up bill up here with the other members at 237, so you can see what it looks like. We'll recess till 25. Come back to order. We've got a set of proposed amendments to Senate Bill 237, and I'm going to have, you should all have a copy of the amendments and a mock-up of the bill. And I'm going to have Mr. Sadler go over the amendments with us.
Okay.
As soon as he finishes with the Patterson Amendment.
How much detail do you want?
Put the member Patterson in first.
Okay. There was probably a lot of things left out. There's one amendment that was certainly left out.
Be really comforting.
Page 5, line 18. We want to delete the period and insert.
That's all gone.
Page 5. There's reinstated.
Line 18. Oh, there's reinstated. I'm sorry.
Including all buildings essential to the operation of the school.
And that was already adopted. This was.
So we'll pencil or we'll pen that in now, so that'll be part of these amendments. Okay?
Okay, you want us to just run through the.
Some of these amendments are amendments that we already made.
You mentioned that.
On page 1, line 9, conforms is put back in, and is in substantial compliance is removed because that language was not intended to be in this bill in the first place.
And we did that last week.
On page 2, line 31, the definition of marginal land is changed to include marginal land that is rural residential use cannot be made marginal land. In other words, somebody that owns rural residential land can go to the local planner and request that his land be designated marginal. He would probably want to do that to get the farm use assessment. He would have to meet the income test under those sections. And B, land outside areas designated for urban or rural residential use on approved plans. This is all just, I believe this is all just to clarify the existing language. Sales is changed to income, and that's just to conform to language in the rest of the Act. Line 35, I think you should.
Yeah, Dick, you want to come up and explain the impact of the change on line 35?
Mr. Chairman, Richard Bennett with 1,000 Frames. The change on line 35 from 70% to 50% has the effect of making more land in small ownerships eligible to be or would qualify as marginal land. And I think the reason that this change is proposed is that there is some land in the valley, in the Willamette Valley, that was not determined by LCDC to be committed to non-farm and non-forest use, even though it was in relatively small ownerships. And the farmers believe that if it's as small as is stated here on lines 35 through 37, it probably is, as a matter of fact, impracticable to farm it, and it's unlikely that in ownerships that small, it would be consolidated into a commercial farm or operation. To give you an example of the effect of that change, a planner from our organization went out to Washington County on Friday and looked at ownership maps in an area of the county that has been contested between Washington County and LCDC. There are approximately 40,000 acres in Washington County, principally in the Chehalem Mountain, the hills of the Chehalem Mountain area. The county has placed it in an AF-20 zone, which does not technically qualify under Goal 3 as an exclusive farm use zone. LCDC has been telling the county that it has to change that zone to make it an exclusive farm zone. By changing the figure 70% to 50%, we went out there and did a looked at some of the areas and looked at the ownership sizes. We found that by changing the 70 to 50, the few areas we had time to look at, there was a fairly dramatic change in the amount of land that qualified. A very little qualified if the figure were kept at 70%. That is, looking at an area of 320 acres, if you said that 70% of that area had to be an ownership smaller than 20 acres, very little qualified. If you change it to just 50%, a substantial portion of those areas qualified, and they are generally areas